I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is a serial entrepreneur, Gary Kremen. Gary is the founder of Match.com, an online dating service that he started in 1993. Gary is also the founder of Clean Power Finance, an online marketplace for the solar energy sector, and Sociogramics, a financial services company that uses social media and behavioral economics to provide capital to consumers who don't otherwise have access to credit. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm honored to be here.
I'd like to start with your upbringing. You grew up in Chicago. What did your parents do?
Both of my parents were teachers in the Chicago public school system. My dad was a driver's ed instructor. My mom taught accounting 37 years for my father.
What were you like as a kid?
Probably bratty. I was kind of a habitual problem child. While I was a good student, I ended up at the police a couple times. I remember one of my claims to fame is I broke all these windows and the police picked me up and made me go to the property owners and apologize. And me and a friend sat in the cell. And then another time we climbed the roof of our elementary school and broke a window and they took money from the Coke machine. I mean, I got kicked out of school for changing a program. And this was in the 70s and printing out some profanity. And that was that kind of intellectual problem child.
Did you have girlfriends growing up?
I had one girlfriend, but I wasn't very good at it, and maybe Match.com was my way of trying to, the idea of online dating was my way of kind of maybe more, getting more deal flow, as we call it today.
What were some odd jobs that you had as a kid?
I spent years actually working after school in a warehouse loading and unloading trucks. Mm. In fact, I worked for this guy who was a pretty good entrepreneur who did things like when Burger King had a misprint on glasses they were handing out. Like there was a misspelling. He would buy them all at 3 cents on a dollar and sell them in loco bodegas, you know. And I would be loading and unloading trucks for him for years and years and years. And when Pan Am went out of business, he bought all the little tchotchkes, like the little pins they gave kids and all the safety vests that were under the seat and found buyers for it. Mm-hmm. So that was like probably my first example of someone who could figure out how to make a profit in the situation.
You went to Northwestern. You graduated in 1985 and then made your way to Stanford Business School. Why do you think Stanford Business School accepted you?
Well, I talked about being an entrepreneur, and I had kind of an unconventional background because out of undergraduate, I decided I wanted to work in a nonprofit looking for fraud, mismanagement, and waste in the Department of Defense. And I think that was different from the normal investment bankers and consultants they had.
But you did work at Goldman Sachs one summer.
I did.
During Stanford Business School, and you rubbed one of the managing directors the wrong way, such that they offered to pay you to leave. What happened there?
They did. They offered to buy my summer out after about week four to leave them alone. I don't know if I rubbed one person wrong. I think I rubbed everyone wrong.
So did you kind of get a rise from challenging authority? Was this something that you liked to perpetuate, or this is just, you know, Gary Kremen?
Just the way I am, that sometimes me being there 4 weeks, I thought I knew as much as, you know, managing partners that have been there 20 years.
After graduating from Stanford Business School in 1989, you started two companies because you knew you were better off with your own gig. The first was a software company and then a computer securities company called Los Altos Technologies. And it was at Los Altos where the idea for an online dating company hatched. Can you explain how the idea for Match.com came to you?
So I had an epiphany one day. I noticed that we started getting purchase orders for our products. And I noticed that one day we got a purchase order from a woman. Mm-hmm. And that never happened in my history before, that actually getting email on the internet from some woman. And we're sitting around the office thinking, I wonder if, you know, what she's like and if there's any way we could learn more about her. And I realized that, oh, more women were going to get on the internet, because back then there were hardly any on the internet. And I realized, I wonder if I could create a database of all the women who are coming online and sell access to it and then marry number one.
Hmm.
Sort. Mary number one.
And Mary number one.
That's right.
This was the first woman, the woman who placed this order. Did you think you might marry her? Or
she could have been, and I was curious. So uh-huh. I wonder if I could convince her. I wonder if I could get her zip code. I had it. Actually, I had her zip code. I wonder if I could find the closest Kinko's, convince her to go scan her picture in, and then do a write-up on her. Hmm. So that was kind of some of my first ideas.
Because this certainly was top of mind was finding a mate.
Top of mind was finding a mate. And then just not me. I noticed there was a market in it on both sides. So at about the same time, I did my first good setup. I set up a friend with another friend, and they got married. I was like, wow, I wonder if they should have paid me for that whole process.
You at the time were also active in telephone dating services. You would pay $2.99 a minute for these 1-900 numbers. How did they work?
So there were newspapers out there, a lot of the alternative newspapers. All they were a little bit of content around these listings for 900 numbers, and you would read a little short description. You would call, paying $2.99 a minute to hear a description, a more detailed description, and then leave a message. And I realized a lot of people who own not only these newspapers, but other newspapers and classified, so were more richer than me. In fact, I didn't have too much money, but they did, and I wanted some of their money.
In 1993, you started a company called Electric Classifieds Incorporated with Match.com as your first service, and the idea was to take offline classifieds and put them online.
That's right. I realized that newspapers would be slow. I went to go talk to a couple of them, and I said, if I have all these domain names, I could create brands around each categories and put these newspapers out of business.
So your first subset of this electronic classifieds was Match.com, this online dating idea, and you bought the domain name for $2,500, which at the time, you know, was a pretty hefty number. Only 5% of Americans had internet access. How did you go about buying the domain name? From whom?
So, you know, first I used my credit card cash advance, as many entrepreneurs do. And I found the guy who was registered to, some person in Las Vegas who tried to do something in email and dating, and it never happened. And I think I came out of the blue like some sucker who was willing to write a check for something that had no value. I had this vision that I could do this whole thing through email, and you could say send picture of person number 27 and the picture would show up. And actually, that's what happened. That's how the early days were before the web.
Right, because this was an email dating service before the World Wide Web became more popular.
In fact, most people didn't even know the web was going to be. There were some alternate ideas, things called links and Archie, and no one knew where it was going to evolve. Mm. So we built a system that could talk to many different protocols, including faxes. People could fax in, and we'd use optical character recognition and realize what they were asking for. But eventually, the email service took off. We're growing at 3-4% a day.
How did the email service take off? Who were some of those early adopters?
Well, I realized something from talking to friends of mine, women friends, that I was able to kind of understand what some of their needs were in this area that was kind of a tough area, which is putting yourself out online where everyone could see what you were looking for, which was kind of a taboo area. I realized that privacy, security, and anonymity were very important. So I kind of came up with the idea of the anonymous handle that would have email and really focusing on respect in the process and the belief that one woman would bring 100 men, at least back then.
So give an example. So, Janet Smith wants to find a boyfriend, so she emails you, Gary, her picture.
Or maybe she just emails her biographical info, and we would do matching in our database to find out who would be looking for someone like Janet Smith around her, and we would send her the list in email.
So you would look at a database, just a list of guys who had signed up?
Now, it was done by an algorithm that we wrote and everything like that. But yeah, basically that was the idea. It's called matching. We matched.
Were you a participant in this?
No, actually, by that time, I actually had a girlfriend, which was hard to believe, but I did have one. So I was more of a looking at the process, but I wasn't touching the goods, so to speak.
I see.
Now, she did touch the goods and married someone from the service.
Now, at the time, you had a girlfriend, so you weren't using Match.com. Have you ever used Match.com?
I've never used it. Not that I'm against the idea or anything like that. It was just the circumstances.
You are married now.
I am.
And you have two children, two boys. How did you meet your wife?
I met my wife through a mutual friend who didn't know that we were each interested. So what I did when I realized I really need to get married is I made an offer. And if you set me up with the woman I marry, you get a trip to Hawaii for two.
Who did you make the offer to?
Everyone I knew.
What is her name and what does she do?
Her name's Petia, and she's a physician who specializes in integrative and holistic healthcare. I knew she was the one. And I think, you know, maybe by date four, she knew I was the one. You know, after we worked some those issues out, like the dog thing and stuff like that.
I remember when I first was learning about Match.com that there was a stigma attached to, oh, joining Match.com. And people were kind of embarrassed by it. That seems to have dissipated over the years now. How many marriages and how many successful matches have there been?
So probably successful matches in the millions, definitely the same number of marriages, but the stigma was the biggest obstacle to success. And worked pretty hard to make it a safe, secure, and friendly place and kind of change behaviors and beliefs that this is a positive, not a negative. It's definitely a feature, not a bug.
So what were some examples of things that you did to try to mitigate that stigma?
Absolute privacy, booting creepy people off quickly, throttling the amount of emails people could send to others, doing good matches, telling people if there was no match, there was just no match. Truthfulness, transparency.
The service, the email service, as well as the website eventually, started really growing 3-4% a day, really through word of mouth. What was one of those catalysts or turning points that really helped to escalate the popularity and growth of the service?
You know, one that I would say is I like to say we invented affiliate marketing. As far as I know, before we did it, no one came up with the idea of actively going out and marketing links to your website as opposed to marketing your web name and URL. And I was a big believer that let's go get the Women's Wire of the world to have a dating section and we'll be the back end for it. So I think the idea of affiliate marketing, something we all take for granted, was one of the ways we did very well. And two is we kept our service running. I know it's the craziest thing, but it's kind of an entrepreneurial lesson that you could have something great, but if it's not working all the time, it's kind of a suboptimum consumer experience.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is a serial entrepreneur, Gary Kremen. Gary is the founder of Match.com, an online dating service that he started in 1993. We'll hear more from Gary coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is the serial entrepreneur, Gary Kremen. Gary is the founder of Match.com, an online dating service that he started in 1993. In addition to Match.com, you owned a number of generic domain names, jobs.com, housing.com, autos.com, and then sex.com, which was later the subject of a lawsuit. Whom did you acquire these domain names from in the early 1990s?
There was one organization giving them away, and no one thought of going to ask. So I had an epiphany that generic words that are in the classified advertising would be very valuable one day. So there happened to be a little government contractor called Network Solutions in Herndon, Virginia, that somehow wrangled the exclusive right to give out these domain names, and they weren't getting paid per domain name because they were free. They were getting paid by, they would add up their costs and add 20% and charge the National Science Foundation for it. They were basically an office of four or five people who coordinated the handing out of IP addresses and domain names and associated internet artifacts. And they hit on, and I think about 95, that they should be charging $75 from that. That later was bought by VeriSign and became a huge public company just based on the revenue from that.
Did you pick up the phone and call them and say, hey, I want to buy jobs.com?
So I sent in to an email address and I said, I wanted jobs.com, and I filled out a form. And I did that for all the domain names except the one that I did last, which was sex.com. And I realized, okay, I don't want this to get lost in email or someone on the other side to see what a good idea is. So I sent in a certified letter, and that was really good because there was a record of a certified letter.
So going back to Match.com, you raised about $4 million from angel investors and venture capital funds, and they invested in Electric Classifieds, which owned Match.com. And very early on, you and they did not see eye to eye. What are some examples of divergent points of view?
There was a couple different divergent points of view. Divergent point of view number one was, I believe that working with newspapers was doomed to fail. They were slow. They didn't get it in today's vernacular. Most of my board wanted to go work with newspapers, and that's kind of how they thought, well, let's go work with big companies. That's good. And I felt smaller entrepreneurial companies would grab the market, and I was actually right on that. Number two is, once when Match took off, I wanted to focus on that. I wanted to run with the winner. And they were like, well, let's go be the outsource partner for newspapers. And I just felt too slow. We'd never get there.
You owned a number of domain names at the time, jobs.com, housing.com, autos.com, sex.com. And they were fine with putting all these domain names under the auspices of Electric Classifieds, except for sex.com. Why did they not want sex.com in there?
Well, it was one in a many series of embarrassments that traditional stodgy venture capitalists who are backed by pension funds feel. The word sex were embarrassed. When I introduced gay dating, they almost had heart attacks right there and then, and they kind of told me not to do it, and I did it anyhow. When I said not everyone's for marriage, some people are looking for shorter-term relationships, I think I almost got fired that day.
Sex.com ended up being not just a scandalous affair, which we'll get to, but also your most lucrative domain name that you owned.
That's true. That's true. So that was another strategic mistake they made. I mean, I made a lot of my own mistakes, please. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm Mr. Mistake.
So what are some other mistakes that you made in the early days of Match.com?
So didn't understand the importance of who's on your board. Thinking all money is green was a big mistake. And I think I was pretty abrasive as a leader. I mean, I made a lot of leadership mistakes. I think I got the strategy right, for sure, but the tactics I wasn't as good at.
I heard a story that you fired a personal assistant or an administrative assistant because she wouldn't work 7 days a week. Is that true?
That's true, because everyone else was working 7 days a week, and it felt that there's always something to do, even if it's emptying the wastebasket, and I felt that that wasn't team spirit if you're going to take Sundays off. Because I was working Sundays, and I expected everyone else to work Sundays.
You were the CEO of Match.com for the first 2 years before you were ousted by the board.
That's right.
How did you feel when they voted you out?
You know, it hurt my feelings. I think that was one area where they were right. I was not mature enough to see that back then.
But at the time, you were just despondent and thought, these guys don't know what they're talking about.
Well, I have another good story. So when I raised money from the investors I did raise the money from, I had an offer from another set of investors, a more prestigious set of investors, like the best venture funds, Kleiner Perkins, IVP. And their condition on the investment was that I bring in a CEO. They had two conditions. One is bring in a CEO, and they would be let me part of the process. And two, they wanted to merge me with this other company, and I would have half the equity, and these other six people would have the other half of the equity. But no, they taught me in school, you want to be the leader, you want to be the CEO. So I said no. So I took the people who said you could be the CEO. Now that company went on, those six guys went on to change their name from Architects to Excite, and I would have had half of Excite and part Vested too. One of those, you know, couple $100 million mistakes that are common in my career.
And Excite went on to
be Excite worth at home and worth billions at the peak.
You left the company after 2 years, and the company was ultimately sold in 1997 for $7 million to Sendint, which is a consumer service company. And a year and a half later, the company was sold for $50 million to City Search Ticketmaster, which is owned by IAC, Barry Diller's Interactive Corporation. You made $50,000 from that sale.
I did.
How did that happen?
Well, it was part of the dispute over what direction the company wanted to do. But actually, the story worked out okay. I'll tell you the whole story. So what happened is I said, no, let's focus on this winter match. Let's have nothing to do with newspapers. We had big fights over it, and the board wanted to do the strategy of enabling newspapers to get online. And after they sold it, after my fervent objective, the company raised lots of money and it went out of business in 2001.
What company?
Match.com's parent, Electric Classifieds. They raised a lot more money trying to sell the newspapers, and it went out of business.
Got it.
So that was bad. But the good thing is I invented a bunch of things, and we got some patents. Like, I invented dynamic web pages, something every website uses today. So in 2004, a couple years later, I went and bought the debt in the last round, and I had a foreclosure sale to get that patent. And some other bidders came in, and I owned enough debt that on my $30,000 investment, I made a couple $1 million. So okay. That's better than a sharp stick in the eye.
So it was more than $50,000 in a very indirect manner.
Yeah, it was very indirect. But the real thing, $50K.
You had given up equity along the way,
ultimately? Yeah. And it's not that anyone else made any money. In fact, I think I was the only one who got any liquidity, even $50K. They all lost everything.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Gary Kremen, the founder of Match.com, the world's largest online dating service. After the sale of Match.com, how were you doing?
Well, I was definitely bumming about the situation, but it was in such a good time in 1997 where a lot was going on. And I did have some unique knowledge. So I started working with a guy or two who had some ideas around collaborative filtering, something we see recommendation engines back then, and got that merged with a company called Firefly, and we eventually sold it to Microsoft.
For how much?
That was, I think, total $40 million. Mm-hmm. So that didn't suck.
Contemporaneous with these successful investments, you had a tumultuous period with a lawsuit over the ownership of sex.com. You had owned the domain name and contended that somebody had fraudulently taken it from you. Can you describe that briefly?
Sure. So I registered the name in 1994, first person who ever registered it. And I wasn't really focusing on it. I had all these other entrepreneurial things I was working on. And one day someone said, hey, didn't you own that name, sex.com? And I'm saying, yeah. And they go, no, this guy, Stephen Michael Cohen, has it's registered under his name. And I'm like, what? And I look it up, and it was true. It did. So I found out Mr. Cohen, who is a 5-time convicted felon, bankruptcy fraud, obstruction of justice, impersonating a judge, impersonating a lawyer, he stole the name from me. And he started, put up a website, and he was soon making about $1 million a month off the name.
Now, at the time, ownership of URLs or of domain names wasn't as secure as it is now, because it was really still the early days. So when you say he stole the name from you, how did that happen?
So initially, this is going to sound dumb, but I didn't realize how valuable the name was. I didn't know anything about the sex industry. I didn't realize it was such a big deal. So I had a little kind of investment firm, and there was a lawyer just fresh out of law school named Sherry Falco, and I gave her $2,500 to go investigate what happened. And that's how the whole thing started. And she found out about this, and then she got a call from the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office saying, well, the reason Mr. Cohen now has the name, even whether he took it or not, is he had a trademark on the name. So we let it drop. We found out later that he was impersonating the USPTO, one of many things that he's impersonated in the case. So after
he had called her directly?
Oh, yeah, and said he was from the Patent and Trademark Office. And she believed it, and I believed it, too. And it hit us later that you can't have trademarks on generic words. So eventually we filed this lawsuit.
And so you found yourself associated with the porn industry pretty publicly. What was your view of that?
Well, what can you do? I needed the money. While at the time I was having legal bills of $100,000 or $200,000 a month, I needed financial support for what I was doing. I didn't have liquidity from my investments yet.
And how much of your mind space or of your headspace was this lawsuit taking up while you were trying to focus on your investing?
Well, eventually it took up 110% of my time. I learned the law. I read every brief, every pleading, which there was over 1,700. It's the longest case, I believe, in the Northern District.
When you finally got sex.com back, what did you do with the site until you sold it?
So I didn't want to run an adult site, and I came up with the idea of turning it into a search engine because there was so much traffic, and then selling those search results to other search engines. And eventually I sold it.
Isn't that effectively running an adult site or perpetuating the porn industry?
Okay, I didn't kill the porn industry. I had to eat. I had to pay my $5.6 million of legal bills I had.
And your judgment was $65 million in damages, but you didn't get the $65 million, so...
Oh, absolutely not. In fact, I've still been collecting. So all I got out of it was a lot of heartache. I did get a house eventually. I did take the bad guy's house, and I lived in it for a couple of years.
Really? How did it make you feel to be, like, in the bedroom of the bad guy? Why would you do that? Of all houses you could choose.
It was kind of a nice house. It was in Rancho Santa Fe, which is this nice area of... Yes, that's true. A nice area of San Diego. And I just, I don't know, you know, there was something to it because he tormented me so much. Yeah, there was a little redemption. I mean, some of it was functional. Some might be dysfunctional. I sold it a couple of years ago.
Your income stream has been kind of erratic, it seems. You haven't had a steady flow of income.
I have not, and banks are always saying something to me about that.
Was there a time after you started Match.com where you were worried about, you know, your financial state?
No, because I was always living pretty low. So I was living in the Western Edition section of San Francisco in a $300 share, and I was eating burritos for years and years and years. So I kept my burn rate super, super low. And the landlord didn't like the fact that I wasn't making any money. And I don't know. So I'm actually sometimes a nice person. So I met this like semi-homeless guy and I let him sleep on my couch for a couple days. And he took some pictures of the guy leaving and he tried to evict me.
You have since moved away from the dating and the adult industry to a cleaner energy, the cleaner energy sector. How have you made that shift? Was it a mindful shift or an accidental one?
Well, I've always been interested in not always the energy part, but sustainable living and systems that would work forever and that were light touch on the environment, kind of the leaving no trace. I've always had an interest in that area. So just after I sold sex.com, I invested in a friend's company, and she had women-friendly solar panels was her idea. So I gave her money to kind of produce these, well, what I thought they were going to be mustard or taupe-colored solar panels, racking systems, because her belief was that women were some of the big decision makers in the purchase of solar, and they're ugly. And if they made them, and it made sense to me. So what happened was not as many people were buying the mustard or taupe colored panels as she thought. And I asked her why, and I go, aren't you selling to all these rich people? She said they don't have the money up front for it. And I had this epiphany of the idea of why not create a financing company to finance solar panels. And if the financing product would be correctly designed, the consumers would pay less than the cost of energy from their utility bill, and they'd want to sign up for that. And that actually worked out. I wrote some software that helped the installer do their job, and then they all ran this software, and then we introduced the financing product eventually. I mean, there was a lot of twists and turns.
Now, Kleiner Perkins is one of the investors in this company. Who are the other venture folks?
Claremont Creek Ventures, Google, Clean Pacific Ventures, and a lot of individual angels, including myself.
Were you at all worried that your reputation would be tainted in this new chapter of yours as you were raising capital, for instance?
I was a little bit. The good news is investors want to make money, and, you know, any challenges in reputation stop when you have a good idea. They want to make money. They don't care about the past as much, I found. As an investor, I'm kind of like that, too.
This time around, you brought in a CEO. You knew you didn't want to be the CEO. Is that just a matter of growing up? I mean, you were 30. You were in your late 20s, early 30s when you were launching Match.com and trying to run it. Is there anything else that is attributable to this change?
Well, I've heard, Jessica, if someone hits you on the head enough times, you remember, like, oh, I don't want to be hit on the head. So I remembered, I'm not that good of a manager of people. Why don't I find someone who is a good manager of people?
Now, your other company, Sociogramics, which you launched in 2010, is a financial service company that facilitates lending to the underbanked. And you're using social media tools to help determine credit worthiness. What's an example of a social media tool that you might use to influence responsible borrowing?
Let me give you
borrowing.
A really clear example. Today, when someone applies for a loan, if they can't find them at the credit bureau, they're usually just denied unilaterally. But there's a lot of people who aren't in the credit bureau or don't have an extensive credit file. We believe that using social media, finding their profiles out there and other traces of them and other ways of verifying they're real people with real jobs, that's good enough reasons to lend to them.
Your idea for Sociogramics came from a personal place. What is that story briefly?
So I had a great relationship with a bank in Marin, California. And I knew the officers there. They knew my story. They knew my situation. And they could tailor products and services to me. The bank got taken over by a large bank, Union Bank. And it was like night and day difference. Instead of talking to the CEO when I had a need or my representative, it was a call center. And the relationship soured quickly. And it got me thinking why the personal touch is not only important from the consumers, it's important from the bank side. So I got thinking, is there a way we could use software to bring back community lending? One of our ideas is start bringing back essays and having people write about what they're going to do with the money and what's there been history of repayment. And I think there's a lot of efficacy to that.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
I'm honored to be here, Jessica.
My guest has been Gary Krimen. Coming up, we'll meet Emily Weiss, founder of Glossier. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Emily Weiss, founder of the online beauty products company, Glossier. Emily launched Glossier's first line of skin products in 2014. In 2010, she founded Into the Gloss, an online community dedicated to beauty. Visitors get tips on skin, hair, makeup, and learn the beauty routines of leading members of the cosmetic and fashion industries. Prior to starting Glossier and Into the Gloss, Emily was a fashion assistant at Vogue and W magazines. Welcome.
Thank you. You know everything about me.
Is that all there
That's
is?
That's it. That's it. We can stop.
Well, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
How would you describe what Into the Gloss is?
The reason for being for Into the Gloss is really that as a, in the time I was a 25-year-old, style-minded, you know, very enthusiastic consumer of beauty and fashion. And I'd always loved beauty products, but I really didn't know where to look except going to a store to talk to someone who I'd never met before to give me advice. I thought that seemed kind of silly. So what I wanted to do was interview all my heroes. You said this interview will be an hour, and I was like, oh, no problem. I do this all the time. I sit on floors of women's bathrooms from Arianna Huffington to Alexa Chung to, you know, Selena Gomez and Isabel Marant and ask them about their approach to beauty. Mm. And that's not a simple question. The idea was really to bring beauty to the internet in a meaningful way.
Where does the conversation go beyond what is my beauty regimen?
Oh, all over. If you think about it, your relationship to beauty begins at a very young age, from watching your mother, from what she does, from not being allowed to use certain things, and then, you know, having to go out on your own, you know, from learning how to shave your legs to cutting yourself open to, you know, crazy eyebrow trauma suffered in teen years, tadpole brows. So it's not just the kind of Us Weekly, what's in your bag. It's not just what you're currently doing. It's everything that's gotten you there.
One's relationship with beauty, it's such a personal and complex relationship. Yet there were so few places that you could go to where people were talking about just that mm-hmm. in 2010. And it's striking how, you know, fashion is much more public, right? Mm-hmm. Fashion has been pervasive. It's in every magazine. And it's sort of like beauty's coat.
Yeah, I think I like to say that's a really insightful comment because even from the beginning of Into the Gloss, I was kind of mad. I started to understand that beauty is almost like this kid's sister, this ugly stepsister to fashion. Like the clothes come first. It's all about the outfit. It's all about the shoes. And then you figure out your face and your hair kind of after.
Ironically, because that's probably, you know, what's most personal and important to every person.
Right. Ironically, it's like really this I mean, who isn't tormented by their hair, right? You're always figuring out what to do with it. So I think it is, I often in my life found that I started with beauty. Even just, you know, anecdotally, like changing my hair from brown to platinum blonde a couple of years ago, I was like a whole different person. People didn't recognize me. And then I started dressing in an entirely different way.
We started this interview with a sound check where I asked, you know, what did you eat this morning? And you said, you know, you're on a cleanse and you're eating these shakes with almond butter and what else?
So many things. Flaxseed oil, coconut oil, almond milk.
The reason I mention it is, you know, it's sort of like the gas in your gas tank that helps to bring the beauty to the surface. It's all about the self in a way.
Yes.
And I think of Maslow's like hierarchy of needs. We have warmth and food and, you know, so next comes like self-actualization.
Thank you.
As part of all that, right?
I can't believe you're saying this because this is actually what I've been kind of banging on about is in the beauty industry, it's been founded on, I mean, you're talking about a $250 billion global industry. It's a storied industry with heritage brands like Estee Lauder and Helena Rubinstein and Elizabeth Arden who have, you know, were built 50 years ago and 60 years ago when technology was totally different, when communications and media were completely different, and when women were completely different. And I think, you know, when those women created these really pioneering companies, they were addressing the needs of women at that time. And I think a big message that happened was very much about glamour, very much about fantasy, very much about a homogenous sort of image of perfect and white picket fence and husband and lady of leisure and, you know, blonde kids running around with a Labrador and Palm Beach and, you know, this sort of high life. And I think right now, I mean, it just couldn't be more different for the most part in terms of what women aspire to. Mm. And I think what women aspire to now is self-actualization, and that has replaced this sex sells fantasy. Mm. So it's not sex sells. I actually think it's self sells. I mean, most of my friends, at least, I can't speak for all women. When I think about what I aspire to, it's to be the best version of yourself, but you don't aspire to clone, you know, Eva Longoria on the red carpet. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, that's not the ticket to a better, to a happier me.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Emily Weiss, founder of Glossier, a digital direct-to-consumer beauty products company. She's also the founder of Into the Gloss, a website focused on beauty that she launched in 2010. Going back to the early days, when you were starting your blog, you were working full-time at Vogue for Alisa Santisi, the style director. You would work on your blog when?
Yeah, that's, I thank God I did that when I was like 25 because I would not be able to do that now because it took a lot of stamina. But I would transcribe interviews from, you know, 4 a.m. till 8 and then put up and write and edit whatever photos or, you know, interviews and then go to work by 9:30. And then I would typically shoot the features, you know, upcoming features on the weekends.
And Sally Singer, the Vogue editor,
Vogue.com.
She was your first top shelf feature. Top shelf is on your site. You interview people about their beauty regimen. Mm-hmm. Tell me about that.
That was just amazing because I admired Sally. I mean, really, it was an opportunity at 25 to be in a room and actually have FaceTime with these women who I just so admired. And
not just any room. You're in
their
bathroom.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, and you're kind of disarmed. You're seeing something unsavory, no matter what. There's always like something weird. There's like a weird toothbrush that's frayed, and you're like, damn, I wish I would have thrown that out. You know, like you're in it together.
Have you ever done a top shelf interview where you've been surprised by what people's beauty routine is? I don't know. What are some unlikely finds?
I'm always interested in people's aversion or inclusion of plastic surgery. So I'm always really, you know, I always kind of ask. Sometimes I really ask if we're having a certain rapport, you know, I'm like, hey, do you ever get anything done? Do you ever get like, especially women of a certain age, you know, like, you're like, so how do you look so good? You know, tell me. And so it's always interesting to me who kind of fesses up and who doesn't. I have no judgment either way. Some people just are very casual and are like, yeah, I get Botox. I go to this doctor. I go every 6 months. It's great. And other women are like, oh, no, I would never. But you know what? That's personal information. So it's whatever you want.
I want to talk about your background. You grew up in Wilton, Connecticut, although you lived in the South also because your father worked for Pitney Bowes.
Yes.
Now, Pitney Bowes, they put the stamping meter on mail,
postage
right?
meter.
Postage
yeah.
meter.
Yep.
So can you tell me more about your dad's job and your view of his job?
Sure. So the first thing I can tell you about my dad's job is never think that that's a fun game to play, just running pieces of paper through the postage meter to make cool designs, because actually you're printing money.
Because you had a Pitney Bowes machine in your house?
We did, yes. We had a Pitney Bowes machine in the basement, a postage meter.
And your mom is a homemaker.
Yes. And my dad's job, I mean, what I've learned from my dad and how I viewed my dad is he is the American dream. I mean, he is from a, you know, middle-class family in Ohio, didn't graduate college. He started working as a door-to-door salesman of Pitney Bowes products in his early 20s. He used to hand stamp his business cards. Funnily enough, he made my own first Into the Gloss cards with me. We did these little nail polish drops on every card. So each card was different, had a different color. And he ended up rising through the ranks to become president of Pitney Bowes. I learned a ton about, you know, perseverance and patience and hard work. There's probably not really many people out there who could say that I'm not extremely hardworking. Even with Into the Gloss, I spent, I think, $750 of my own money to, invest, quote unquote, in the building of Into the Gloss as a blog, and bought a camera for $500, and, you know, that was it.
What about your mom? Every woman in her moments has some communication with
her daughter.
Yeah, with her daughter, or even unspoken. Like, what did that look like?
I mean, I was very self-motivated by style and beauty. People often say, oh, you know, where did it come from? And it really didn't come from family. I think it came from media and from magazines like Vogue and from movies like Clueless and being in the mall. And I just loved it. And my mom just supported it and was really like, you know, you look crazy, but if you really want to go to school like that with like over the knee stockings, then like you can, but you're 12. So know that that's unusual. And I would say, I know, I'm going to go anyway and get made fun of.
And then what about her? Like, what are images? You know, I think of my mom. She had those curlers. You know, putting curlers
in
my hair.
My mom's pretty, like, wash and go. Her hair, we have the same hair. It's straight, sticks straight. It's brown.
Were you judgy? Did you judge her when you were going through your...
Yeah. No, I don't think so. I mean... No, I would just be like, let's go shopping for me.
You wrote letters to Vogue when you were like 10 years old?
I don't know how old I was, but one was published, and it was a reaction to a Arthur Elgort short skirt story. Arthur Elgort's this like fabulous photographer, and I remember writing this letter, editor's letter to Vogue, and saying, you know, I really appreciate as a young woman your portrayal of miniskirts as like something that can be very classy and done tastefully and like done well, and like bravo, and they published it. I mean, it's not like that big of a deal, but imagine you're like flipping through your new issue as like a 14-year-old, and you see your name and it says Emily Weiss, Wilton, Connecticut. I'm like, I'm famous. This is awesome.
Now, what were some defining moments in your path towards what you're doing now that, you know, you look back on in retrospect?
Well, I would say the biggest, you know, moment for me and Mark, especially in my professional career, was my work with Elisa Santisi when I was, 23 to 25. I mean, I was a really precocious, I was a pain in the ass, like for sure, because I'm super ambitious. I'm really precocious. I have no filter. I say what's on my mind. I'm probably like the worst assistant, but she was so patient with me and we had so much fun. I learned so much from her that I would say it was really the first time in my life I had really worked so closely with another individual. Mm. Like, I'm usually a real loner, and it was really the first time I thought, oh, you know what? I really like teamwork. and I think that was a big moment.
Now, did you know when you were launching this blog that, yes, I want to convert this into something much larger, or did that kind of happen accidentally?
No, I knew it would be successful, but I didn't know what success meant, if that makes sense. So I was an art major at NYU. I never took a business course. And then I figured it out because it was like, oh, I get it. You have if you are a media company, you make money through advertising. So let's get some advertising, you know.
And that's where Carrie Diamond comes
in. Exactly.
So who's Carrie Diamond and how was she helpful?
So I told two people about Into the Gloss. Of course, I told my boss and I said, I'm starting this blog and is that okay? And she said, sure. And the other person who I went to was Eva Chen. She heads up fashion at Instagram, but at the time she was the beauty director of Teen Vogue. And I had never actually worked with Eva, but I asked, hey, can I come talk to you about this crazy idea I have? She said, this is great. You absolutely need to do this, and you need to go meet Carrie Diamond. Carrie is this visionary at Lancôme, the beauty company. I hounded Carrie Diamond. I wrote her all these emails. She's like, who is this person? And finally, I called her one day, and she answered, and I was like, I gotcha. Like, hey, it's me. And she's like, what? And I'm like, hey, can I just come? I'll come anytime. She was like, can you be here in 20 minutes? I said, no problem. So I went to her office at Lancôme, and I showed her my little sketch of how the website would look, because it wasn't up yet. And she said, this is great. Have you talked to any other brands? And I said, no, I don't even know what I'm talking about. What are we talking about? And she said, good. I'm going to give you, I think it was like $2,000 or $5,000 or something. She was like, I'm going to give you $5,000 and I want an exclusive for 6 months on like all your banner ads. And I was like, great. I don't know what a banner ad is, but like, we'll build it. Mm-hmm. And thank you. It was great. It was like, hey, I have the, you know, ears of at least one person at this very, very big company who believes that we're onto something.
I want to talk about raising capital for a moment. Investors include Kirsten Green's Forerunner Ventures, mm-hmm. the entrepreneur Andy Dunn, who founded Bonobos, Josh Kushner's fund Thrive mm-hmm. Capital, the venture capital fund founded by the founder of The Gap, Bill Fisher. Talk to me about that process. And what is it that you told them you wanted to build?
The most influential beauty company of our generation. Kirsten Green, you know, is really someone to note here because venture capital is a highly male-dominated industry, as is the tech industry, as is the startup industry. And Kirsten's fund, it's noteworthy, is all females. She has, I think it's like four women who work with her.
So despite the dearth or the scarcity of women, both at venture firms, but also, you know, starting companies, like what pushback did you face?
I think in life in general, we as humans go off a lot of familiarity and a lot of pattern recognition. And when you're thinking about a room full of men meeting someone like me, coming in and talking to them about something they know nothing about, it's a much harder sell. Mm-hmm. You need to then support it with a ton of data. You need to support it with a ton of numbers. It needs to be really understandable why your mascara is better than the mascara down the street, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's something that I don't expect a table full of men to know as well as if I had come in and started talking about, you know, Dropbox.
Did you explain?
Yeah, I explained. I tried to understand what would help them understand the beauty market, and walking through the drugstore and trying to pick out a lipstick out of a wall of 700 lipstick colors that you can't even test because they're wrapped in plastic is also hard. And going to Sephora and talking to someone who you've never met before who has no idea, you know, who you are is also not ideal. So being able to talk about, you know, the direct-to-consumer relationship that we want to build through our background as being really expert storytellers and expert communicate, you know, really being able to communicate on the channels that women are on, like Instagram, like Snapchat, like, you know, our website and through the comment section, and building a company where we really want to engage her, you mm-hmm. know, and actually really want her to help build it with us and tell us what she's into and us be able to respond to her rather than this kind of archaic way that a lot of brands just have in their DNA where they say, we know best, we're going to make something over here in a place that you can't see and you don't know us, and we're going to throw it over the fence and then we hope you like it, you know, but we're not really going to talk about it with you is all a little bit like funky. That's a lot of the conversation we had.
Building a cosmetics business is very different from building a blog. And so, you know, talk to me about like the chemistry of these products, because I'm kind of a skeptic. Like I look at all this and I'm first of all overwhelmed, and I'm like, you know what? They all work the same. They all have water and, you know, X, Y, and Z, you mm-hmm. know, in the first three ingredients. Mm-hmm. So talk to me about just like the raw chemistry behind yeah. how you went about it.
Absolutely. It's a great question, and it's one that many women have. So the first thing that we did was hire an expert in-house who's product development. you know, done it for 10 years and surrounded ourselves with various advisors and also hired and contracted a independent chemist to work on developing with us, translating all of our ideas and our crazy, you know, ideas and our wants and our needs, kind of like an architect would with a home, mm-hmm. and would say, okay, let me create this recipe for you.
And it's been called, it's a democratic skin line for yep. the Instagram generation because the prices are accessible.
Yes. They're $12 to $28.
One fun part of all of this is that it comes in a bubble wrap bag that kind of has a pink tint, mm-hmm. and that's kind of kid-like.
Yeah, because I think beauty should make you smile. Like, it shouldn't make you feel like, I can't afford this, or it shouldn't make you feel like, should I use this last drop of eye cream because if I use this and I'm out and maybe I'll just use this one on Sundays. It's like, no, you should be able to use this all the time, not sweat it. You can have everything that we make, our whole collection, for under, I think, $200 now. Right. You know, you're like a baller mm-hmm. for having like everything.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
My guest has been Emily Weiss, founder of Glossier.
If you would like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch.